the means of production as well as its subjective factor, labour power. With the keen eye of an expert, he has selected the means of production and the kind of labour power best adapted to his particular trade, be it spinning, boot making, or any other kind. He then proceeds to consume the commodity, the labour power that he has just bought, by causing the labourer, the impersonation of that labour power, to consume the means of production by his labour. The general character of the labour process is evidently not changed by the fact that the labourer works for the capitalist instead of for himself. Moreover, the particular methods and operations employed in boot-making or spinning are not immediately changed by the intervention of the capitalist. He must begin by taking the labour power as he finds it in the market, and consequently be satisfied with labour of such a kind as would be found in the period immediately preceding the rise of capitalists. Changes in the methods of production by the subordination of labour to capital can take place only at a later period, and therefore will have to be treated of in a later chapter. The labour process, turned into the process by which the capitalist consumes labour power, exhibits two characteristic phenomena. First, the labourer works under the control of the capitalist to whom his labour belongs, the capitalist taking good care that the work is done in a proper manner, and that the means of production are used with intelligence, so that there is no unnecessary waste of raw material, and no wear and tear of the implements beyond what is necessarily caused by the work. Secondly, the product is the property of the capitalist and not that of the labourer, its immediate producer. Suppose that a capitalist pays for a day's labour power at its value, then the right to use that power for a day belongs to him, just as much as the right to use any other commodity, such as a horse that he has hired for the day. To the purchaser of a commodity belongs its use, and the seller of labour power, by giving his labour, does no more in reality than part with the use value that he has sold. From the instant he steps into the workshop, the use value of his labour power, and therefore also its use, which is labour, belongs to the capitalist. By the purchase of labour power, the capitalist incorporates labour as a living ferment, with the lifeless constituents of the product. From his point of view, the labour process is nothing more than the consumption of the commodity purchased, that is, of labour power. But this consumption cannot be effected except by supplying the labour power with the means of production. The labour process is a process between things that the capitalist has purchased, things that have become his property. The product of this process belongs, therefore, to him, just as much as does the wine, which is the product of a process of fermentation completed in his cellar. Footnote. Products are appropriated before they are converted into capital. This conversion does not secure them from such appropriation. Chez Boullier, Richesse ou Pauvreté, 1841. The proletarian, by selling his labour for a definite quantity of the necessaries of life, renounces all claim to a share in the product. The mode of appropriation of the products remains the same as before. It is in no way altered by the bargain we have mentioned. The product belongs exclusively to the capitalist, who supplied the raw material and the necessaries of life. And this is a rigorous consequence of the law of appropriation, a law whose fundamental principle was the very opposite, namely, that every labourer has an exclusive right to the ownership of what he produces. When labourers receive wages for their labour, the capitalist is then the owner not of the capital only, he means the means of production, but of the labour also. If what is paid as wages is included, as it commonly is, in the term capital, it is absurd to talk of labour separately from capital. The word capital, as thus employed, includes labour and capital both. James Mill, Elements of Political Economy, 1821. End of footnote. Section 2. The Production of Surplus Value. The product appropriated by the capitalist is a use value, as yarn, for example, or boots. But although boots are, in one sense, the basis of all social progress, and our capitalist is a decided progressist, yet he does not manufacture boots for their own sake. Use value is, by no means, the thing qu'on aime pour lui-même in the production of commodities. Use values are only produced by capitalists because, and insofar as, they are the material substratum, the depositories of exchange value. Our capitalist has two objects in view. In the first place, he wants to produce a use value that has a value in exchange, that is to say, an article destined to be sold, a commodity. And secondly, he desires to produce a commodity whose value shall be greater than the sum of the values of the commodities used in its production, that is, of the means of production and the labour power that he purchased with his good money in the open market. His aim is to produce not only a use value, but a commodity also. Not only use value, but value. Not only value, but at the same time, surplus value. It must be borne in mind that we are now dealing with the production of commodities, and that up to this point we have only considered one aspect of the process. Just as commodities are at the same time use values and values, so the process of producing them must be a labour process, and at the same time, a process of creating value. Footnote. As has been stated in a previous note, the English language has two different expressions for these two different aspects of labour. In the simple labour process, the process of producing use values, it is work. In the process of creating value, it is labour, taking the term in its strictly economic sense. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. Let us now examine production as a creation of value. We know that the value of each commodity is determined by the quantity of labour expended on and materialised in it, by the working time necessary under given social conditions for its production. This rule also holds good in the case of the product that accrued to our capitalist as the result of the labour process carried on for him. Assuming this product to be 10 pounds of yarn, our first step is to calculate the quantity of labour realised in it. For spinning the yarn, raw material is required. Suppose in this case 10 pounds of cotton. We have no need at present to investigate the value of this cotton, for our capitalist has, we will assume, bought it at its full value, say of 10 shillings. In this price, the labour required for the production of the cotton is already expressed in terms of the average labour of society. We will further assume that the wear and tear of the spindle, which for our present purpose may represent all other instruments of labour employed, amounts to the value of 2 shillings. If, then, 24 hours' labour or 2 working days are required to produce the quantity of gold represented by 12 shillings, we have here, to begin with, 2 days' labour already incorporated in the yarn. We must not let ourselves be misled by the circumstance that the cotton has taken a new shape, while the substance of the spindle has to a certain extent been used up. By the general law of value, if the value of 40 pounds of yarn equals the value of 40 pounds of cotton plus the value of a whole spindle, that is, if the same working time is required to produce the commodities on either side of this equation, then 10 pounds of yarn are an equivalent for 10 pounds of cotton together with 1/4 of a spindle. In the case we are considering, the same working time is materialized in the 10 pounds of yarn on the one hand, and in the 10 pounds of cotton and the fraction of a spindle on the other. Therefore, whether value appears in cotton, in a spindle, or in yarn, makes no difference in the amount of that value. The spindle and cotton, instead of resting quietly side by side, join together in the process. Their forms are altered, and they are turned into yarn. But their value is no more affected by this fact than it would be if they had been simply exchanged for their equivalent in yarn. The labour required for the production of the cotton, the raw material of the yarn, is part of the labour necessary to produce the yarn, and is therefore contained in the yarn. The same applies to the labour embodied in the spindle, without whose wear and tear the cotton could not be spun. Hence, in determining the value of the yarn, or the labour time required for its production, all the special processes carried on at various times and in different places, which were necessary first to produce the cotton and the wasted portion of the spindle, and then with the cotton and spindle to spin the yarn, may together be looked on as different and successive phases of one and the same process. The whole of the labour in the yarn is past labour. And it is a matter of no importance that the operations necessary for the production of its constituent elements were carried on at times which, referred to the present, are more remote than the final operation of spinning. If a definite quantity of labour, say 30 days, is requisite to build a house, the total amount of labour incorporated in it is not altered by the fact that the work of the last day is done 29 days later than that of the first. Therefore, the labour contained in the raw material and the instruments of labour can be treated just as if it were labour expended in an earlier stage of the spinning process, before the labour of actual spinning commenced. The values of the means of production, that is, the cotton and the spindle, which values are expressed in the price of 12 shillings, are therefore constituent parts of the value of the yarn, or in other words, of the value of the product. Two conditions must nevertheless be fulfilled. First, the cotton and spindle must concur in the production of a use value. They must, in the present case, become yarn. Value is independent of the particular use value by which it is born, but it must be embodied in a use value of some kind. Secondly, the time occupied in the labour of production must not exceed the time really necessary under the given social conditions of the case. Therefore, if no more than 1 pound of cotton be requisite to spin 1 pound of yarn, care must be taken that no more than this weight of cotton is consumed in the production of 1 pound of yarn, and similarly with regard to the spindle. Though the capitalist have a hobby and use a gold instead of a steel spindle, yet the only labour that counts for anything in the value of the yarn is that which would be required to produce a steel spindle, because no more is necessary under the given social conditions. We now know what portion of the value of the yarn is owing to the cotton and the spindle. It amounts to 12 shillings, or the value of 2 days' work. The next point for our consideration is, what portion of the value of the yarn is added to the cotton by the labour of the spinner? We have now to consider this labour under a very different aspect from that which it had during the labour process. There, we viewed it solely as that particular kind of human activity which changes cotton into yarn. There, the more the labour was suited to the work, the better the yarn, other circumstances remaining the same. The labour of the spinner was then viewed as specifically different from other kinds of productive labour, different on the one hand in its special aim, viz. Spinning, different on the other hand in the special character of its operations, in the special nature of its means of production, and in the special use value of its product. For the operation of spinning, cotton and spindles are a necessity, but for making rifled cannon they would be of no use whatever. Here, on the contrary, where we consider the labour of the spinner only so far as it is value-creating, that is, a source of value, his labour differs in no respect from the labour of the man who bores cannon, or, what here more nearly concerns us, from the labour of the cotton planter and spindle maker incorporated in the means of production. It is solely by reason of this identity that cotton planting, spindle making, and spinning are capable of forming the component parts, differing only quantitatively from each other, of one whole, namely, the value of the yarn. Here we have nothing more to do with the quality, the nature, and the specific character of the labour, but merely with its quantity. And this simply requires to be calculated. We proceed upon the assumption that spinning is simple, unskilled labour, the average labour of a given state of society. Hereafter, we shall see that the contrary assumption would make no difference. When the labourer is at work, his labour constantly undergoes a transformation. From being motion, it becomes an object without motion. From being the labourer working, it becomes the thing produced. At the end of 1 hour's spinning, that act is represented by a definite quantity of yarn. In other words, a definite quantity of labour, namely that of 1 hour, has become embodied in the cotton. We say labour, that is, the expenditure of his vital force by the spinner, and not spinning labour, because the special work of spinning counts here only so far as it is the expenditure of labour power in general, and not in so far as it is the specific work of the spinner. In the process we are now considering, it is of extreme importance that no more time be consumed in the work of transforming the cotton into yarn than is necessary under the given social conditions. If, under normal, that is, average, social conditions of production, A pounds of cotton ought to be made into B pounds of yarn by 1 hour's labour, then a day's labour does not count as 12 hours' labour unless 12A pounds of cotton have been made into 12B pounds of yarn. For in the creation of value, the time that is socially necessary alone counts. Not only the labour, but also the raw material and the product, now appear in quite a new light, very different from that in which we viewed them in the labour process pure and simple. The raw material serves now merely as an absorbent of a definite quantity of labour. By this absorption, it is in fact changed into yarn, because it is spun, because labour power in the form of spinning is added to it. But the product, the yarn, is now nothing more than a measure of the labour absorbed by the cotton. If in 1 hour 1 2/3 pounds of cotton can be spun into 1 2/3 pounds of yarn, then 10 pounds of yarn indicate the absorption of 6 hours' labour. Definite quantities of product, these quantities being determined by experience, now represent nothing but definite quantities of labour, definite masses of crystallized labour time. They are nothing more than the materialization of so many hours or so many days of social labour. We are here no more concerned about the facts that the labour is the specific work of spinning, that its subject is cotton and its product yarn, than we are about the fact that the subject itself is already a product, and therefore raw material. If the spinner, instead of spinning, were working in a coal mine, the subject of his labour, the coal, would be supplied by nature. Nevertheless, a definite quantity of extracted coal, 100 weight, for example, would represent a definite quantity of absorbed labour. We assumed, on the occasion of its sale, that the value of a day's labour power is 3 shillings, and that 6 hours' labour is incorporated in that sum, and consequently that this amount of labour is requisite to produce the necessaries of life daily required on an average by the labourer. If now our spinner, by working for 1 hour, can convert 1 2/3 pounds of cotton into 1 2/3 pounds of yarn, footnote, these figures are quite arbitrary, end of footnote, it follows that in 6 hours he will convert 10 pounds of cotton into 10 pounds of yarn. Hence, during the spinning process, the cotton absorbs 6 hours' labour. The same quantity of labour is also embodied in a piece of gold of the value of 3 shillings. Consequently, by the mere labour of spinning, a value of 3 shillings is added to the cotton. Let us now consider the total value of the product, the 10 pounds of yarn. 2.5 days' labour has been embodied in it, of which 2 days were contained in the cotton and in the substance of the spindle worn away, and 1/2 day was absorbed during the process of spinning. This 2.5 days' labour is also represented by a piece of gold to the value of 15 shillings. Hence, 15 shillings is an adequate price for the 10 pounds of yarn, or the price of 1 pound is 18 pence. Our capitalist stares in astonishment. The value of the product is exactly equal to the value of the capital advanced. The value so advanced has not expanded, no surplus value has been created, and consequently money has not been converted into capital. The price of the yarn is 15 shillings, and 15 shillings were spent in the open market upon the constituent elements of the product, or, what amounts to the same thing, upon the factors of the labour process. 10 shillings were paid for the cotton, 2 shillings for the substance of the spindle worn away, and 3 shillings for the labour power. The swollen value of the yarn is of no avail, for it is merely the sum of the values formerly existing in the cotton, the spindle, and the labour power. Out of such a simple addition of existing values, no surplus value can possibly arise. Footnote. This is the fundamental proposition on which is based the doctrine of the physiocrats as to the unproductiveness of all labour that is not agriculture. It is irrefutable for the orthodox economist. This method of adding to one particular object the value of a number of others, for example, adding the living costs of the weaver to the flax, of, as it were, heaping up various values in layers on top of one single value, has the result that this value grows to the same extent. The expression addition gives a very clear picture of the way in which the price of a manufactured product is formed. This price is only the sum of a number of values which have been consumed, and it is arrived at by adding them together. However, addition is not the same as multiplication. Mercier de la Rivière. End of footnote. These separate values are now all concentrated in one thing. But so they were also in the sum of 15 shillings before it was split up into 3 parts, by the purchase of the commodities. There is in reality nothing very strange in this result. The value of 1 pound of yarn being 18 pence, if our capitalist buys 10 pounds of yarn in the market, he must pay 15 shillings for them. It is clear that whether a man buys his house ready-built or gets it built for him, in neither case will the mode of acquisition increase the amount of money laid out on the house. Our capitalist, who is at home in his vulgar economy, exclaims, "Oh, but I advanced my money for the express purpose of making more money." The way to hell is paved with good intentions, and he might just as easily have intended to make money without producing at all. Footnote. Thus, from 1844 to 47, he withdrew part of his capital from productive employment in order to throw it away in railway speculations, and so also, during the American Civil War, he closed his factory and turned his workpeople into the streets in order to gamble on the Liverpool Cotton Exchange. End of footnote. He threatens all sorts of things. He won't be caught napping again. In future, he will buy the commodities in the market instead of manufacturing them himself. But if all his brother capitalists were to do the same, where would he find his commodities? In the market. And his money he cannot eat. He tries persuasion. Consider my abstinence. I might have played ducks and drakes with the 15 shillings, but instead of that I consumed it productively and made yarn with it. Very well, and by way of reward he is now in possession of good yarn instead of a bad conscience. And as for playing the part of a miser, it would never do for him to relapse into such bad ways as that. We have seen before to what results such asceticism leads. Besides, where nothing is, the king has lost his rights. Whatever may be the merit of his abstinence, there is nothing wherewith specially to remunerate it, because the value of the product is merely the sum of the values of the commodities that were thrown into the process of production. Let him therefore console himself with the reflection that virtue is its own reward. But no, he becomes importunate. He says, "The yarn is of no use to me. I produced it for sale." In that case, let him sell it. Or, still better, let him for the future produce only things for satisfying his personal wants, a remedy that his physician McCulloch has already prescribed as infallible against an epidemic of overproduction. He now gets obstinate. Can the labourer, he asks, merely with his arms and legs, produce commodities out of nothing? Did I not supply him with the materials, by means of which and in which alone his labour could be embodied? And as the greater part of society consists of such ne'er-do-wells, have I not rendered society incalculable service by my instruments of production, my cotton and my spindle, and not only society, but the labourer also, whom in addition I have provided with the necessaries of life? And am I to be allowed nothing in return for all this service? Well, but has not the labourer rendered him the equivalent service of changing his cotton and spindle into yarn? Moreover, there is here no question of service. Footnote. Extol thyself, put on finery, and adorn thyself. But whoever takes more or better than he gives, that is usury, and is not service, but wrong done to his neighbour, as when one steals and robs. All is not service and benefit to a neighbour that is called service and benefit. For an adulteress and adulterer do one another great service and pleasure. A horseman does an incendiary a great service by helping him to rob on the highway and pillage land and houses. The papists do ours a great service in that they don't drown, burn, murder all of them, or let them all rot in prison, but let some live, and only drive them out, or take from them what they have. The devil himself does his servants inestimable service. To sum up, the world is full of great, excellent, and daily service and benefit. Martin Luther. An die Pfarrherren wieder den Zwucher zu predigen. Wittenberg, 1540. A service is nothing more than the useful effect of a use value, be it of a commodity, or be it of labour. Footnote. In Zur Kritik der politischen Ökonomie, I make the following remark on this point. It is not difficult to understand what service the category service must render to a class of economists like J.B. Say and F. Bastia. End of footnote. But here we are dealing with exchange value. The capitalist paid to the labourer a value of 3 shillings, and the labourer gave him back an exact equivalent in the value of 3 shillings added by him to the cotton. He gave him value for value. Our friend, up to this time so purse-proud, suddenly assumes the modest demeanour of his own workman, and exclaims, "Have I myself not worked? Have I not performed the labour of superintendence and of overlooking the spinner? And does not this labour, too, create value?" His overlooker and his manager try to hide their smiles. Meanwhile, after a hearty laugh, he reassumes his usual mien. Though he chanted to us the whole creed of the economists, in reality, he says, he would not give a brass farthing for it. He leaves this and all such like subterfuges and juggling tricks to the professors of political economy who are paid for it. He himself is a practical man, and though he does not always consider what he says outside his business, yet in his business he knows what he is about. Let us examine the matter more closely. The value of a day's labour-power amounts to 3 shillings because, on our assumption, half a day's labour is embodied in that quantity of labour-power, that is, because the means of subsistence that are daily required for the production of labour-power cost half a day's labour. But the past labour that is embodied in the labour-power, and the living labour that it can call into action, the daily cost of maintaining it, and its daily expenditure in work, are 2 totally different things. The former determines the exchange value of the labour-power, the latter is its use value. The fact that half a day's labour is necessary to keep the labourer alive during 24 hours does not in any way prevent him from working a whole day. Therefore, the value of labour-power and the value which that labour-power creates in the labour-process are 2 entirely different magnitudes, and this difference of the 2 values was what the capitalist had in view when he was purchasing the labour-power. The useful qualities that labour-power possesses, and by virtue of which it makes yarn or boots, were to him nothing more than a conditio sine qua non, for in order to create value, labour must be expended in a useful manner. What really influenced him was the specific use-value which this commodity possesses of being a source not only of value, but of more value than it has itself. This is the special service that the capitalist expects from labour-power, and in this transaction he acts in accordance with the eternal laws of the exchange of commodities. The seller of labour-power, like the seller of any other commodity, realises its exchange value and parts with its use value. He cannot take the one without giving the other. The use value of labour-power, or in other words, labour, belongs just as little to its seller as the use value of oil after it has been sold belongs to the dealer who has sold it. The owner of the money has paid the value of a day's labour-power. His, therefore, is the use of it for a day. A day's labour belongs to him. The circumstance that on the one hand the daily sustenance of labour-power costs only half a day's labour, while on the other hand the very same labour-power can work during the whole day, that consequently the value which its use during one day creates is double what he pays for that use, this circumstance is, without doubt, a piece of good luck for the buyer, but by no means an injury to the seller. Our capitalist foresaw this state of things, and that was the cause of his laughter. The labourer therefore finds, in the workshop, the means of production necessary for working not only during 6, but during 12 hours. Just as during the 6 hours process our 10 pounds of cotton absorbed 6 hours labour and became 10 pounds of yarn, so now 20 pounds of cotton will absorb 12 hours labour and be changed into 20 pounds of yarn. Let us now examine the product of this prolonged process. There is now materialized in this 20 pounds of yarn the labour of 5 days, of which 4 days are due to the cotton and the lost steel of the spindle, the remaining day having been absorbed by the cotton during the spinning process. Expressed in gold, the labour of 5 days is 30 shillings. This is therefore the price of the 20 pounds of yarn, giving, as before, 18 pence as the price of a pound. But the sum of the values of the commodities that entered into the process amounts to 27 shillings. The value of the yarn is 30 shillings. Therefore the value of the product is 1/9 greater than the value advanced for its production. 27 shillings have been transformed into 30 shillings. A surplus value of 3 shillings has been created. The trick has at last succeeded. Money has been converted into capital. Every condition of the problem is satisfied, while the laws that regulate the exchange of commodities have been in no way violated. Equivalent has been exchanged for equivalent, for the capitalist as buyer paid for each commodity, for the cotton, the spindle, and the labour power, its full value. He then did what is done by every purchaser of commodities. He consumed their use value. The consumption of the labour power, which was also the process of producing commodities, resulted in 20 pounds of yarn, having a value of 30 shillings. The capitalist, formerly a buyer, now returns to market as a seller of commodities. He sells his yarn at 18 pence a pound, which is its exact value. Yet for all that, he withdraws 3 shillings more from circulation than he originally threw into it. This metamorphosis, this conversion of money into capital, takes place both within the sphere of circulation and also outside it. Within the circulation, because conditioned by the purchase of the labour power in the market. Outside the circulation, because what is done within it is only a stepping stone to the production of surplus value, a process which is entirely confined to the sphere of production. Thus, everything is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. Voltaire, Candide. By turning his money into commodities that serve as the material elements of a new product and as factors in the labour process, by incorporating living labour with their dead substance, the capitalist at the same time converts value, that is, past, materialized, and dead labor, into capital, into value big with value, a live monster that is fruitful and multiplies. If we now compare the two processes of producing value and of creating surplus value, we see that the latter is nothing but the continuation of the former beyond a definite point. If on the one hand the process be not carried beyond the point where the value paid by the capitalist for the labour power is replaced by an exact equivalent, it is simply a process of producing value. If on the other hand it be continued beyond that point, it becomes a process of creating surplus value. If we proceed further and compare the process of producing value with the labour process, pure and simple, we find that the latter consists of the useful labour, the work, that produces use values. Here we contemplate the labour as producing a particular article. We view it under its qualitative aspect alone, with regard to its end and aim. But viewed as a value-creating process, the same labour process presents itself under its quantitative aspect alone. Here it is a question merely of the time occupied by the labourer in doing the work, of the period during which the labour power is usefully expended. Here the commodities that take part in the process do not count any longer as necessary adjuncts of labour power in the production of a definite useful object. They count merely as depositories of so much absorbed or materialised labour. That labour, whether previously embodied in the means of production or incorporated in them for the first time during the process by the action of labour power, counts in either case only according to its duration. It amounts to so many hours or days, as the case may be. Moreover, only so much of the time spent in the production of any article is counted, as is, under the given social conditions, necessary. The consequences of this are various. In the first place, it becomes necessary that the labour should be carried on under normal conditions. If a self-acting mule is the implement in general use for spinning, it would be absurd to supply the spinner with a distaff and spinning wheel. The cotton, too, must not be such rubbish as to cause extra waste in being worked, but must be of suitable quality. Otherwise the spinner would be found to spend more time in producing a pound of yarn than is socially necessary, in which case the excess of time would create neither value nor money. But whether the material factors of the process are of normal quality or not depends not upon the labourer, but entirely upon the capitalist. Then again, the labour power itself must be of average efficacy. In the trade in which it is being employed, it must possess the average skill, handiness, and quickness prevalent in that trade, and our capitalist took good care to buy labour power of such normal goodness. This power must be applied with the average amount of exertion and with the usual degree of intensity, and the capitalist is as careful to see that this is done as that his workmen are not idle for a single moment. He has bought the use of the labour power for a definite period, and he insists upon his rights. He has no intention of being robbed. Lastly, and for this purpose our friend has a penal code of his own, all wasteful consumption of raw material or instruments of labour is strictly forbidden, because what is so wasted represents labour superfluously expended, labour that does not count in the product or enter into its value. Footnote. This is one of the circumstances that makes production by slave labour such a costly process. The labourer here is, to use a striking expression of the ancients, distinguishable only as instrumentum vocale from an animal, as instrumentum semivocale, and from an implement as instrumentum mutum. But he himself takes care to let both beast and implement feel that he is none of them, but is a man. He convinces himself with immense satisfaction that he is a different being by treating the one unmercifully and damaging the other con amore. Hence the principle, universally applied in this method of production, only to employ the rudest and heaviest implements, and such as are difficult to damage, owing to their sheer clumsiness. In the slave states bordering on the Gulf of Mexico, down to the date of the Civil War, ploughs constructed on old Chinese models, which turned up the soil like a hog or a mole instead of making furrows, were alone to be found. John Eliot Cairns, The Slave Power, London, 1862. In his Seaboard Slave States, Olmsted tells us, "I am here shown tools that no man in his senses with us would allow a labourer, for whom he was paying wages, to be encumbered with, and the excessive weight and clumsiness of which I would judge would make work at least 10% greater than with those ordinarily used with us. And I am assured that, in the careless and clumsy way they must be used by the slaves, anything lighter or less rude could not be furnished them with good economy, and that such tools as we constantly give our labourers and find our profit in giving them would not last out a day in a Virginia cornfield, much lighter and more free from stones, though, it be than ours. So, too, when I ask why mules are so universally substituted for horses on the farm, the first reason given, and confessedly the most conclusive one, is that horses cannot bear the treatment that they always must get from Negroes. Horses are always soon foundered or crippled by them, while mules will bear cudgelling, or lose a meal or two now and then, and not be materially injured, and they do not take cold or get sick, if neglected or overworked. But I do not need to go further than to the window of the room in which I am writing, to see at almost any time treatment of cattle that would ensure the immediate discharge of the driver by almost any farmer owning them in the North. End of footnote. We now see that the difference between labour, considered on the one hand as producing utilities, and on the other hand as creating value, a difference which, we discovered by our analysis of a commodity, resolves itself into a distinction between two aspects of the process of production. The process of production, considered on the one hand as the unity of the labour process and the process of creating value, is production of commodities. Considered on the other hand as the unity of the labour process and the process of producing surplus value, it is the capitalist process of production, or capitalist production of commodities. We stated previously that in the creation of surplus value, it does not in the least matter whether the labour appropriated by the capitalist be simple unskilled labour of average quality or more complicated skilled labour. All labour of a higher or more complicated character than average labour is expenditure of labour power of a more costly kind, labour power whose production has cost more time and labour, and which therefore has a higher value than unskilled or simple labour power. This power being higher value, its consumption is labour of a higher class, labour that creates in equal times proportionally higher values than unskilled labour does. Whatever difference in skill there may be between the labour of a spinner and that of a jeweller, the portion of his labour by which the jeweller merely replaces the value of his own labour power does not in any way differ in quality from the additional portion by which he creates surplus value. In the making of jewellery, just as in spinning, the surplus value results only from a quantitative excess of labour, from a lengthening out of one and the same labour process, in the one case of the process of making jewels, in the other of the process of making yarn. Footnote. The distinction between skilled and unskilled labour rests in part on pure illusion, or, to say the least, on distinctions that have long since ceased to be real, and that survive only by virtue of a traditional convention, in part on the helpless condition of some groups of the working class, a condition that prevents them from exacting equally with the rest the value of their labour power. Accidental circumstances here play so great a part that these two forms of labour sometimes change places. Where, for instance, the physique of the working class has deteriorated and is, relatively speaking, exhausted, which is the case in all countries with a well-developed capitalist production, the lower forms of labour, which demand great expenditure of muscle, are in general considered as skilled, compared with much more delicate forms of labour. The latter sink down to the level of unskilled labour. Take as an example the labour of a bricklayer, which in England occupies a much higher level than that of a damask weaver. Again, although the labour of a fustian cutter demands great bodily exertion and is at the same time unhealthy, yet it counts only as unskilled labour. And then we must not forget that the so-called skilled labour does not occupy a large space in the field of national labour. Lang estimates that in England and Wales, the livelihood of 11,300,000 people depends on unskilled labour. If, from the total population of 18 million living at the time when he wrote, we deduct 1 million for the genteel population and 1,500,000 for paupers, vagrants, criminals, prostitutes, etc., and 4,650,000 who compose the middle class, there remain that 11 million. But in his middle class he includes people that live on the interest of small investments, officials, men of letters, artists, schoolmasters, and the like. And in order to swell the number, he also includes in these 4,650,000 the better-paid portion of the factory operatives. The bricklayers, too, figure amongst them. S. Lang, National Distress, etc., London, 1844. The great class, who have nothing to give for food but ordinary labour, are the great bulk of the people. James Mill, Colony, Supplement to the Encyclopaedia Britannica, 1831. End of footnote. But on the other hand, in every process of creating value, the reduction of skilled labour to average social labour, for example, 1 day of skilled to 6 days of unskilled labour, is unavoidable. Footnote. Where reference is made to labour as a measure of value, it necessarily implies labour of one particular kind, the proportion which the other kind bear to it being easily ascertained. Outlines of Political Economy, 1832. End of footnote. We therefore save ourselves a superfluous operation, and simplify our analysis by the assumption that the labour of the workman employed by the capitalist is unskilled, average labour. Chapter 8. Constant Capital and Variable Capital. The various factors of the labour process play different parts in forming the value of the product. The labourer adds fresh value to the subject of his labour by expending upon it a given amount of additional labour, no matter what the specific character and utility of that labour may be. On the other hand, the values of the means of production used up in the process are preserved and present themselves afresh as constituent parts of the value of the product. The values of the cotton and the spindle, for instance, reappear again in the value of the yarn. The value of the means of production is therefore preserved by being transferred to the product. This transfer takes place during the conversion of those means into a product, or in other words, during the labour process. It is brought about by labour. But how? The labourer does not perform two operations at once, one in order to add value to the cotton, the other in order to preserve the value of the means of production, or, what amounts to the same thing, to transfer to the yarn, to the product, the value of the cotton on which he works, and part of the value of the spindle with which he works. But, by the very act of adding new value, he preserves their former values. Since, however, the addition of new value to the subject of his labour and the preservation of its former value are two entirely distinct results, produced simultaneously by the labourer during one operation, it is plain that this twofold nature of the result can be explained only by the twofold nature of his labour. At one and the same time, it must in one character create value, and in another character preserve or transfer value. Now, in what manner does every labourer add new labour and consequently new value? Evidently, only by labouring productively in a particular way. The spinner by spinning, the weaver by weaving, the smith by forging. But, while thus incorporating labour generally, that is, value, It is by the particular form alone of the labour, by the spinning, the weaving, and the forging, respectively, that the means of production, the cotton and spindle, the yarn and loom, and the iron and anvil, become constituent elements of the product, of a new use value. Footnote. Labour gives a new creation for one extinguished. An Essay on the Political Economy of Nations, London, 1821. End of footnote. Each use value disappears, but only to reappear under a new form, in a new use value. Now we saw, when we were considering the process of creating value, that if a use value be effectively consumed in the production of a new use value, the quantity of labour expended in the production of the consumed article forms a portion of the quantity of labour necessary to produce the new use value. This portion is therefore labour transferred from the means of production to the new product. Hence the labourer preserves the values of the consumed means of production, or transfers them as portions of its value to the product, not by virtue of his additional labour, abstractedly considered, but by virtue of the particular useful character of that labour, by virtue of its special productive form. In so far, then, as labour is such specific productive activity, in so far as it is spinning, weaving, or forging, it raises, by mere contact, the means of production from the dead, makes them living factors of the labour process, and combines with them to form the new products. If the special productive labour of the workman were not spinning, he could not convert the cotton into yarn, and therefore could not transfer the values of the cotton and spindle to the yarn. Suppose the same workman were to change his occupation to that of a joiner. He would still, by a day's labour, add value to the material he works upon. Consequently, we see, first, that the addition of new value takes place not by virtue of his labour being spinning in particular, or joinering in particular, but because it is labour in the abstract, a portion of the total labour of society. And we see next that the value added is of a given definite amount, not because his labour has a special utility, but because it is exerted for a definite time. On the one hand, then, it is by virtue of its general character, as being expenditure of human labour power in the abstract, that spinning adds new value to the values of the cotton and the spindle. And on the other hand, it is by virtue of its special character as being a concrete, useful process, that the same labour of spinning both transfers the values of the means of production to the product and preserves them in the product. Hence, at one and the same time, there is produced a twofold result. By the simple addition of a certain quantity of labour, new value is added. And by the quality of this added labour, the original values of the means of production are preserved in the product. This twofold effect, resulting from the twofold character of labour, may be traced in various phenomena. Let us assume that some invention enables the spinner to spin as much cotton in 6 hours as he was able to spin before in 36 hours. His labour is now 6 times as effective as it was for the purposes of useful production. The product of 6 hours' work has increased sixfold from £6 to £36. But now the 36 pounds of cotton absorb only the same amount of labour as formerly did the £6. 1/6 as much new labour is absorbed by each pound of cotton, and consequently the value added by the labour to each pound is only 1/6 of what it formerly was. On the other hand, in the product, in the 36 pounds of yarn, the value transferred from the cotton is 6 times as great as before. By the 6 hours spinning, the value of the raw material preserved and transferred to the product is 6 times as great as before, although the new value added by the labour of the spinner to each pound of the very same raw material is 1/6 what it was formerly. This shows that the two properties of labour, by virtue of which it is enabled in one case to preserve value and in the other to create value, are essentially different. On the one hand, the longer the time necessary to spin a given weight of cotton into yarn, the greater is the new value added to the material. On the other hand, the greater the weight of the cotton spun in a given time, the greater is the value preserved by being transferred from it to the product. Let us now assume that the productiveness of the spinner's labour, instead of varying, remains constant, that he therefore requires the same time as he formerly did to convert 1 pound of cotton into yarn, but that the exchange value of the cotton varies, either by rising to 6 times its former value or falling to 1/6 of that value. In both these cases, the spinner puts the same quantity of labour into a pound of cotton, and therefore adds as much value as he did before the change in value. He also produces a given weight of yarn in the same time as he did before. Nevertheless, the value that he transfers from the cotton to the yarn is either 1/6 of what it was before the variation, or, as the case may be, 6 times as much as before. The same result occurs when the value of the instruments of labour rises or falls, while their useful efficacy in the process remains unaltered. Again, if the technical conditions of the spinning process remain unchanged, and no change of value takes place in the means of production, the spinner continues to consume in equal working times equal quantities of raw material, and equal quantities of machinery of unvarying value. The value that he preserves in the product is directly proportional to the new value that he adds to the product. In 2 weeks, he incorporates twice as much labour, and therefore twice as much value as in 1 week, and during the same time he consumes twice as much material, and wears out twice as much machinery, of double the value in each case. He therefore preserves, in the product of 2 weeks, twice as much value as in the product of 1 week. So long as the conditions of production remain the same, the more value the labourer adds by fresh labour, the more value he transfers and preserves. But he does so merely because this addition of new value takes place under conditions that have not varied and are independent of his own labour. Of course, it may be said in one sense that the labourer preserves old value always in proportion to the quantity of new value that he adds. Whether the value of cotton rise from 1 shilling to 2 shillings, or fall to 6 pence, the workman invariably preserves in the product of 1 hour only 1/2 as much value as he preserves in 2 hours. In like manner, if the productiveness of his own labour varies by rising or falling, he will in 1 hour spin either more or less cotton, as the case may be, than he did before, and will consequently preserve in the product of 1 hour more or less value of cotton. But all the same, he will preserve by 2 hours' labour twice as much value as he will by one. Value exists only in articles of utility, in objects. We leave out of consideration its purely symbolical representation by tokens. Man himself, viewed as the impersonation of labour power, is a natural object, a thing, although a living conscious thing, and labour is the manifestation of this power residing in him. If, therefore, an article loses its utility, it also loses its value. The reason why means of production do not lose their value, at the same time that they lose their use value, is this. They lose in the labour process the original form of their use value, only to assume in the product the form of a new use-value. But however important it may be to value that it should have some object of utility to embody itself in, yet it is a matter of complete indifference what particular object serves this purpose. This we saw when treating of the metamorphosis of commodities. Hence it follows that in the labour process the means of production transfer their value to the product only so far as, along with their use value, they lose also their exchange value. They give up to the product that value alone which they themselves lose as means of production. But in this respect, the material factors of the labour process do not all behave alike. The coal, burnt under the boiler, vanishes without leaving a trace. So too the tallow, with which the axles of wheels are greased. Dyestuffs and other auxiliary substances also vanish, but reappear as properties of the product. Raw material forms the substance of the product, but only after it has changed its form. Hence raw material and auxiliary substances lose the characteristic form with which they are clothed on entering the labour process. It is otherwise with the instruments of labour. Tools, machines, workshops, and vessels are of use in the labour process only so long as they retain their original shape and are ready each morning to renew the process with their shape unchanged. And just as during their lifetime, that is to say, during the continued labour process in which they serve, they retain their shape independent of the product, so too they do after their death. The corpses of machines, tools, workshops, etc., are always separate and distinct from the product they help to turn out. If we now consider the case of any instrument of labour during the whole period of its service, from the day of its entry into the workshop till the day of its banishment into the lumber room, we find that during this period its use value has been completely consumed, and therefore its exchange value completely transferred to the product. For instance, if a spinning machine lasts for 10 years, it is plain that during that working period its total value is gradually transferred to the product of the 10 years. The lifetime of an instrument of labour, therefore, is spent in the repetition of a greater or less number of similar operations. Its life may be compared with that of a human being. Every day brings a man 24 hours nearer to his grave. But how many days he has still to travel on that road, no man can tell accurately by merely looking at him. This difficulty, however, does not prevent life insurance offices from drawing, by means of the theory of averages, very accurate and at the same time very profitable conclusions. So it is with the instruments of labour. It is known by experience how long, on the average, a machine of a particular kind will last. Suppose its use value in the labour process to last only 6 days. Then, on the average, it loses each day 1/6 of its use value, and therefore parts with 1/6 of its value to the daily product. The wear and tear of all instruments, their daily loss of use value, and the corresponding quantity of value they part with to the product, are accordingly calculated upon this basis. It is thus strikingly clear that means of production never transfer more value to the product than they themselves lose during the labour process by the destruction of their own use value. If such an instrument has no value to lose, if, in other words, it is not the product of human labour, it transfers no value to the product. It helps to create use value without contributing to the formation of exchange value. In this class are included all means of production supplied by nature without human assistance, such as land, wind, water, metals in situ, and timber in virgin forests. Yet another interesting phenomenon here presents itself. Suppose a machine to be worth £1,000 and to wear out in 1,000 days. Then 1,000th part of the value of the machine is daily transferred to the day's product. At the same time, though with diminishing vitality, the machine as a whole continues to take part in the labour process. Thus it appears that one factor of the labour process, a means of production, continually enters as a whole into that process, while it enters into the process of the formation of value by fractions only. The difference between the two processes is here reflected in their material factors, by the same instrument of production taking part as a whole in the labour process, while at the same time, as an element in the formation of value, it enters only by fractions. Footnote. The subject of repairs of the implements of labour does not concern us here. A machine that is undergoing repair no longer plays the part of an instrument, but that of a subject of labour. Work is no longer done with it, but upon it. It is quite permissible for our purpose to assume that the labour expended on the repairs of instruments is included in the labour necessary for their original production. But in the text we deal with that wear and tear, which no doctor can cure, and which little by little brings about death, with that kind of wear which cannot be repaired from time to time, and which, in the case of a knife, would ultimately reduce it to a state in which the cutler would say of it, "It is not worth a new blade." We have shown in the text that a machine takes part in every labour process as an integral machine, but that into the simultaneous process of creating value it enters only bit by bit. How great, then, is the confusion of ideas exhibited in the following extract. Mr. Ricardo says a portion of the labour of the engineer in making stocking machines is contained, for example, in the value of a pair of stockings. Yet the total labour that produced each single pair of stockings includes the whole labour of the engineer, not a portion. For one machine makes many pairs, and none of those pairs could have been done without any part of the machine. The author, an uncommonly self-satisfied wiseacre, is right in his confusion, and therefore in his contention, to this extent only, that neither Ricardo nor any other economist, before or since him, has accurately distinguished the two aspects of labour, and still less, therefore, the part played by it under each of these aspects in the formation of value. End of footnote. On the other hand, a means of production may take part as a whole in the formation of value, while into the labour process it enters only bit by bit. Suppose that in spinning cotton, the waste for every £115 used amounts to £15, which is converted not into yarn, but into devil's dust. Now, although this £15 of cotton never becomes a constituent element of the yarn, yet assuming this amount of waste to be normal and inevitable under average conditions of spinning, its value is just as surely transferred to the value of the yarn as is the value of the £100 that forms the substance of the yarn. The use value of £15 of cotton must vanish into dust before £100 of yarn can be made. The destruction of this cotton is therefore a necessary condition in the production of the yarn. And because it is a necessary condition, and for no other reason, the value of that cotton is transferred to the product. The same holds good for every kind of refuse resulting from a labour process, so far at least as such, refuse cannot be further employed as a means in the production of new and independent use values. Such an employment of refuse may be seen in the large machine works at Manchester, where mountains of iron turnings are carted away to the foundry in the evening, in order the next morning to reappear in the workshops as solid masses of iron. We have seen that the means of production transfer value to the new product, so far only as during the labour process they lose value in the shape of their old use value. The maximum loss of value that they can suffer in the process is plainly limited by the amount of the original value with which they came into the process, or in other words, by the labour time necessary for their production. Therefore, the means of production can never add more value to the product than they themselves possess independently of the process in which they assist. However useful a given kind of raw material, or a machine, or other means of production may be, though it may cost £150, or, say, 500 days' labour, yet it cannot, under any circumstances, add to the value of the product more than £150. Its value is determined not by the labour process into which it enters as a means of production, but by that out of which it has issued as a product. In the labour process, it only serves as a mere use value, a thing with useful properties, and could not, therefore, transfer any value to the product unless it possessed such value previously. Footnote. From this we may judge of the absurdity of J.B. Say, who pretends to account for surplus value, interest, profit, rent, by the service productif, which the means of production, soil, instruments, and raw material, render in the labour process by means of their use values. Mr. Wilhelm Rocher, who seldom loses an occasion of registering, in black and white, ingenious apologetic fancies, records the following specimen. J.B. Say very truly remarks, "The value produced by an oil mill, after deduction of all costs, is something new, something quite different from the labour by which the oil mill itself was erected." Very true, Mr. Professor. The oil produced by the oil mill is indeed something very different from the labour expended in constructing the mill. By value, Mr. Rocher understands such stuff as oil, because oil has value, notwithstanding that nature produces petroleum, though relatively, in small quantities, a fact to which he seems to refer in his further observation, "It, nature, produces scarcely any exchange value." Mr. Rocher's nature, and the exchange value it produces, are rather like the foolish virgin, who admitted indeed that she had had a child, but it was such a little one. This savant sérieux, in continuation, remarks, "Ricardo's school is in the habit of including capital as accumulated labour under the head of labour. This is unskilful work, because, indeed, the owner of capital, after all, does something more than merely creating and preserving of the same, namely, the abstention from the enjoyment of it, for which he demands, for example, interest." How very skilful is this anatomico-physiological method of political economy, which, indeed, converts a mere desire, after all, into a source of value. End of footnote. While productive labour is changing the means of production into constituent elements of a new product, their value undergoes a metempsychosis. It deserts the consumed body to occupy the newly created one. But this transmigration takes place, as it were, behind the back of the labourer. He is unable to add new labour to create new value without at the same time preserving old values. And this, because the labour he adds must be of a specific, useful kind. And he cannot do work of a useful kind without employing products as the means of production of a new product, and thereby transferring their value to the new product. The property, therefore, which labour power in action, living labour, possesses of preserving value at the same time that it adds it, is a gift of nature which costs the labourer nothing, but which is very advantageous to the capitalist inasmuch as it preserves the existing value of his capital. Footnote. Of all the instruments of the farmer's trade, the labour of man is that on which he is most to rely for the repayment of his capital. The other two, the working stock of the cattle, and the carts, ploughs, spades, and so on, without a given portion of the first, are nothing at all. Edmund Burke, Thoughts and Details on Scarcity. Originally presented to the Right Honourable William Pitt in the month of November 1795. End of footnote. So long as trade is good, the capitalist is too much absorbed in money-grubbing to take notice of this gratuitous gift of labour. A violent interruption of the labour process by a crisis makes him sensitively aware of it. Footnote. In the Times of the 26th of November, 1862, a manufacturer whose mill employed 800 hands and consumed on the average 150 bales of East Indian or 130 bales of American cotton, complains in a doleful manner of the standing expenses of his factory when not working. He estimates them at £6,000 a year. Among them are a number of items that do not concern us here, such as rent, rates and taxes, insurance, salaries of the manager, bookkeeper, engineer and others. Then he reckons £150 for coal, used to heat the mill occasionally and run the engine now and then. Besides this, he includes the wages of the people employed at odd times to keep the machinery in working order. Lastly, he puts down £1,200 for depreciation of machinery, because the weather and the natural principle of decay do not suspend their operations because the steam engine ceases to revolve. He says, emphatically, he does not estimate his depreciation at more than the small sum of £1,200, because his machinery is already nearly worn out. End of footnote. As regards the means of production, what is really consumed is their use value, and the consumption of this use value by labour results in the product. There is no consumption of their value, and it would therefore be inaccurate to say that it is reproduced. Footnote. Productive consumption, where the consumption of a commodity is a part of the process of production, in these instances there is no consumption of value. S. P. Newman. End of footnote. It is rather preserved, not by reason of any operation it undergoes itself in the process, but because the article in which it originally exists vanishes, it's true, but vanishes into some other article. Hence, in the value of the product, there is a reappearance of the value of the means of production, but there is, strictly speaking, no reproduction of that value. That which is produced is a new use value, in which the old exchange value reappears. Footnote. In an American compendium that has gone through perhaps 20 editions, this passage occurs. It matters not in what form capital reappears. Then, after a lengthy enumeration of all the possible ingredients of production whose value reappears in the product, the passage concludes thus. The various kinds of food, clothing, and shelter necessary for the existence and comfort of the human being are also changed. They are consumed from time to time, and their value reappears in that new vigour imparted to his body and mind, forming fresh capital to be employed again in the work of production. F. Wayland. Without noticing any other oddities, it suffices to observe that what reappears in the fresh vigour is not the bread's price, but its blood-forming substances. What, on the other hand, reappears in the value of that vigour is not the means of subsistence, but their value. The same necessaries of life, at half the price, would form just as much muscle and bone, just as much vigour, but not vigour of the same value. This confusion of value and vigour, coupled with our author's pharisaical indefiniteness, mark an attempt, futile for all that, to thrash out an explanation of surplus value from a mere reappearance of pre-existing values. End of footnote. It is otherwise with the subjective factor of the labour process, with labour power in action. While the labourer, by virtue of his labour being of a specialised kind that has a special object, preserves and transfers to the product the value of the means of production, he at the same time, by the mere act of working, creates each instant an additional or new value. Suppose the process of production to be stopped just when the workman has produced an equivalent for the value of his own labour power, when, for example, by 6 hours' labour, he has added a value of 3 shillings. This value is the surplus of the total value of the product over the portion of its value that is due to the means of production. It is the only original bit of value formed during this process, the only portion of the value of the product created by this process. Of course, we do not forget that this new value only replaces the money advanced by the capitalist in the purchase of the labour power, and spent by the labourer on the necessaries of life. With regard to the money spent, the new value is merely a reproduction. But nevertheless, it is an actual, and not, as in the case of the value of the means of production, only an apparent reproduction. The substitution of one value for another is here effected by the creation of new value. We know, however, from what has gone before, that the labour process may continue beyond the time necessary to reproduce and incorporate in the product a mere equivalent for the value of the labour power. Instead of the 6 hours that are sufficient for the latter purpose, the process may continue for 12 hours. The action of labour power, therefore, not only reproduces its own value, but produces value over and above it. This surplus value is the difference between the value of the product and the value of the elements consumed in the formation of that product. In other words, of the means of production and the labour power. By our explanation of the different parts played by the various factors of the labour process in the formation of the product's value, we have, in fact, disclosed the characters of the different functions allotted to the different elements of capital in the process of expanding its own value. The surplus of the total value of the product over the sum of the values of its constituent factors is the surplus of the expanded capital over the capital originally advanced. The means of production on the one hand, labour power on the other, are merely the different modes of existence which the value of the original capital assumed when from being money it was transformed into the various factors of the labour process. That part of capital, then, which is represented by the means of production, by the raw material, auxiliary material, and the instruments of labour, does not, in the process of production, undergo any quantitative alteration of value. I therefore call it the constant part of capital, or more shortly, constant capital. On the other hand, that part of capital represented by labour power does, in the process of production, undergo an alteration of value. It both reproduces the equivalent of its own value and also produces an excess, a surplus value, which may itself vary, maybe more or less, according to circumstances. This part of capital is continually being transformed from a constant into a variable magnitude. I therefore call it the variable part of capital, or shortly, variable capital. The same elements of capital which, from the point of view of the labour process, present themselves respectively as the objective and subjective factors, as means of production and labour power, present themselves from the point of view of the process of creating surplus value as constant and variable capital. The definition of constant capital thus given by no means excludes the possibility of a change of value in its elements. Suppose the price of cotton to be one day sixpence a pound, and the next day, in consequence of a failure of the cotton crop, a shilling a pound. Each pound of the cotton bought at sixpence, and worked up after the rise in value, transfers to the product a value of 1 shilling, and the cotton already spun before the rise, and perhaps circulating in the market as yarn, likewise transfers to the product twice its original value. It is plain, however, that these changes of value are independent of the increment or surplus value added to the value of the cotton by the spinning itself. If the old cotton had never been spun, it could, after the rise, be resold at 1 shilling a pound instead of at sixpence. Further, the fewer the processes the cotton has gone through, the more certain is the result. We therefore find that speculators make it a rule, when such sudden changes in value occur, to speculate in that material on which the least possible quantity of labour has been spent. To speculate, therefore, in yarn rather than in cloth, in cotton itself rather than in yarn. The change of value in the case we have been considering originates not in the process in which the cotton plays the part of a means of production, and in which it therefore functions as constant capital, but in the process in which the cotton itself is produced. The value of a commodity, it is true, is determined by the quantity of labour contained in it, but this quantity is itself limited by social conditions. If the time socially necessary for the production of any commodity alters, and a given weight of cotton represents, after a bad harvest, more labour than after a good one, all previously existing commodities of the same class are affected, because they are, as it were, only individuals of the species, and their value at any given time is measured by the labour socially necessary, that is, by the labour necessary for their production under the then existing social conditions. Footnote. Properly speaking, all products of the same kind form a single mass, and their price is determined in general and without regard to particular circumstances. Le Trône. End of footnote. As the value of the raw material may change, so too may that of the instruments of labour, of the machinery, etc., employed in the process, and consequently that portion of the value of the product transferred to it from them may also change. If, in consequence of a new invention, machinery of a particular kind can be produced by a diminished expenditure of labour, the old machinery becomes depreciated more or less, and consequently transfers so much less value to the product. But here again, the change in value originates outside the process in which the machine is acting as a means of production. Once engaged in this process, the machine cannot transfer more value than it possesses apart from the process. Just as a change in the value of the means of production, even after they have commenced to take a part in the labour process, does not alter their character as constant capital, so too a change in the proportion of constant to variable capital does not affect the respective functions of these two kinds of capital. The technical conditions of the labour process may be revolutionised to such an extent that where formerly 10 men, using 10 implements of small value, worked up a relatively small quantity of raw material, one man may now, with the aid of one expensive machine, work up 100 times as much raw material. In the latter case, we have an enormous increase in the constant capital that is represented by the total value of the means of production used, and at the same time a great reduction in the variable capital invested in labour power. Such a revolution, however, alters only the quantitative relation between the constant and the variable capital, or the proportions in which the total capital is split up into its constant and variable constituents. It has not in the least degree affected the essential difference between the two. Chapter 9. The Rate of Surplus Value. Section 1. The Degree of Exploitation